Thank you. The time being 1 o'clock, I will call this meeting of the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee to order. Today is March 18th, 2026. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. We have three minutes before us. First is March 4th. Do I have anybody who would like to move approval of the minutes from March 4th? Vice Chair Lee, would you like to move approval?
I move the minutes from March 4th.
Okay. Any discussion to the minutes of March 4th? Okay, seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. I have the minutes of March 9th. Representative Coulter, would you like to move the minutes of March 9th?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Coulter has moved approval of the minutes of March 9th. Any discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. And then we have the minutes of March 11th. Representative Roach, would you like to move approval of the minutes of March 11th? Just thought I'd catch you by surprise there.
Yes.
Okay, Representative Roach, thank you for moving approval of the minutes. Any discussion to the minutes of March 11th? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. The minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3698. Welcome to the committee, Representative Gottfried. So I will move, I will make the motion to recommend to re-refer House File 3698 to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. And I would just like to note our jurisdiction here is public libraries. The bill is, assuming we vote in favor of it, it will go to Commerce where they will have discussions on the terms and conditions of the bill. So welcome to the committee, Representative Gottfried. Please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. House File 3698 is a bill that seeks to address a problem where publicly funded libraries are being price gouged by distributors of ebooks and audiobooks. These distributors are charging more for one loanable ebook for fewer uses than a typical physical copy would be used. This bill fixes this by setting common sense parameters around the contracts that public libraries enter while using taxpayer dollars. This legislation will put public dollars to better use, alleviate pressure on county and school district budgets, and despite what you may hear from some other testimony today, make authors' work more available to readers through one of the biggest discovery channels in the country, that being public libraries. To underscore this point, I would ask that you please take a look at the letter of support for this bill written by Minnesota author William Kent Krueger. And now to speak more to the specifics of the situation that we're attempting to solve, I will turn it over to Ms. Sarah Hawkins here.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Hawkins. I am the Assistant Director at Anoka County Library. I am also the Legislative Chair of the Minnesota Library Association. Today we're here to talk about ebook access for Minnesota libraries and why House File 3698 is urgently needed. The goal today is to provide an overview of the current challenges surrounding ebook purchasing in Minnesota and outline our proposed legislative approach. Under current publisher licensing models, libraries must pay significantly higher prices for digital copies than for physical books, often several times more. These inflated costs are driven by restrictive contract terms that limit how libraries can purchase, use, and lend ebooks. As a result, library budgets are strained, and Minnesotans face reduced access to the digital materials they rely on for reading, learning, and research. This pricing model has been unsustainable for more than a decade and has been identified as a top priority by the Minnesota Library Association, representing librarians from public, school, academic, and special libraries. Connecticut recently enacted legislation requiring more equitable contract terms for libraries. For their law to take effect, at least one or more states with a combined population of 7 million must pass similar legislation. Minnesota has introduced 3698 to adjust ebook licensing terms, ensuring fair, sustainable access to digital collections. So the core problem. Right now, libraries do not actually own ebooks, we lease them. We pay 3 to 5 times more than consumers, and licenses expire after 2 years or 26 checkouts. This means taxpayer dollars go towards short-lived rentals rather than long-term community assets. Other challenges include rising costs, the inability to use interlibrary loan for ebooks, and vendor non-disclosure agreements that block transparency. To put this in perspective, print books are purchased once, owned permanently, and can circulate years, sometimes lasting more than 70 checkouts or 10 years. Ebooks, by contrast, expire quickly. Vendors can change pricing at any time, and the digital model reverses almost all normal purchasing norms. For authors, digital sales don't guarantee higher earnings. Vendors can take up to 30% off the top, and authors receive only 10 to 30% of the net, meaning they consistently earn the lowest percentage across all formats. These issues create challenges in three key areas: access, accessibility, and fiscal responsibility. High ebook prices and restrictions on sharing titles between libraries limit access in many communities. Many school libraries rely on public library collections because they cannot afford or cannot purchase their own. Digital audiobooks and ebooks are essential for patrons with visual or reading impairments and students with IEPs or 504 plans. When libraries cannot access ebooks affordably, they cannot fulfill their mission of serving all. Fiscal responsibility is another major concern. Because libraries must repeatedly lease the same titles, taxpayers end up paying far more over a title's lifetime. Limited dollars reduce the library's ability to meet patron demand and build robust collections. An example, in the Twin Cities, we have the highest circulating consortium worldwide, with 13.98 million checkouts in 2025 of our ebooks and e-audiobooks. Metro libraries in 2025 invested $6.5 million on digital content, yet our unmet need remains over 21 million. Libraries don't want to spend less. We want more value for what we do spend. An example, one popular Minnesota author, Metro Libraries purchased 835 licenses of that author's titles at a cost of $55,711. And even then, more than 2,400 readers were still waiting for access to those titles. All of those licenses will expire, and libraries will need to repurchase those licenses next year. Of that 55,000, about 16,000 went to the vendor off the top, 31,000 to the publisher, and roughly 7,800 to the author. This system is costly, inefficient, and unsustainable. Importantly, high library ebook prices do not benefit authors. They mainly protect the publisher and vendor revenue. Authors and libraries are natural partners. Libraries drive discovery, and library patrons are also book buyers. With about 1.3 billion annual public library circulations nationwide, nearly twice the number of retail print book sales, libraries play a crucial role in connecting readers to authors. Library borrowing increases author discovery, leading to future sales. And then authors are paid fixed royalty rates that do not rise with inflated library pricing. Publishers and vendors retain the majority of the revenue. Fair library pricing increases access, reduces wait lists, and leads to more readers discovering and ultimately purchasing the author's work. Again, the current system inflates prices because the market allows it, not because it benefits the authors. In nearly every other form of government purchasing, such as software licensing, agencies receive discounts, transparent contracts, and caps on annual price increases. Conversely, ebook vendors provide none of these safeguards. Instead, they impose non-disclosure agreements, no price caps, and no transparency. Ebook pricing is currently a major outlier in public purchasing norms, and taxpayers ultimately bear the cost. Connecticut adopted a practical legislative approach using contract law, focusing on what publicly funded libraries control, how they spend their taxpayer dollars. The law stops libraries from signing agreements that block lending, limit restrictions on how many times a digital item can circulate, ensures libraries can buy multiple copies on release day, prohibits non-disclosure agreements, protects patron privacy, and requires that if licenses have time limits, other options such as paper use or perpetual access must also be available for the library. Overall, terms must be reasonable and fair for a library's mission. This approach protects taxpayer dollars, ensures broad access, and it also avoids overregulating the publishing industry. It is practical, enforceable, and it's a model for reform. House File 3698 is Minnesota's version. It would protect taxpayer dollars, restore local control, ensure sustainable ebook access, supports schools and communities, and strengthens Minnesota's reading ecosystem. This bill applies to public and K-12 school libraries and aims to protect taxpayer dollars, restore local control, and ensure access to our collections. Libraries increase total reading, support literacy and educational attainment, and they serve communities that the retail market does not always reach. Fair and transparent ebook licensing is critical. Restricted access harms literacy, it weakens markets, and reduces consumer welfare. Supporting libraries means supporting the largest source of reading in the United States. Thank you for your time, and I ask you to support House File 3698.
Thank you for your testimony. I believe Co-Chair Quam has a question regarding one of your slides.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, there were two different slides that I had questioned on. Slide two, you state 3 to 5X, but your graphic includes two examples, and they're 3X. Where's the 5X example?
Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. This is the estimated average cost per title on that slide. So that is the average that we're paying is three times over, but we do have specific examples that are up to five times more.
Co-Chair Quam.
Thank you. Average, if you're varying between three and five, I would assume it wouldn't be exactly three. So on to the other one, on slide five, you comment about there still being 2,451 readers waiting. How many readers actually had an opportunity to read?
Sarah Hawkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I don't have that number right in front of me. Like I said, we did purchase 835 copies. I'd be happy to follow up after and give you the number of how many people did get access to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is not trivial. If you're putting in here, we know exactly how many people were still waiting to read these, and you don't have included how many got to. That would allow us to have an understanding of what's accessible with the multiple readings of or accesses and et cetera. Those kind of details help us to understand the exact case as opposed to just a few things thrown on a slide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The next testifier, if you could identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Stacey Hendren. I am the Deputy Director of Public Service for the Rochester Public Library. I'm here today to ask you to support House File 3698. As one of the first libraries in the state to offer digital content, Rochester Public Library has a long-standing history of providing access to ebooks and e-audiobooks to Olmsted County. And through our partnership with the local regional systems Selco and Traverse des Sioux to residents throughout southeastern and south central Minnesota. With this partnership, there are over 25,000 unique users of the ebook service. Digital books from libraries are a huge opportunity for people who have difficulty reading small text, for those with dyslexia, for those with long commutes, for those who need assistive technology due to medical issues, and many more reasons. One of our elementary school readers with low vision has struggled to find materials to read. There are not a lot of large print books published for that age to meet their interests and needs or allow for choice. Their library card provided access to online ebooks, and with features that adjust text scale, lighting and font, the world has opened up for this child. Yet, due to the unfair contracts, we can't keep up with the demand, and we aren't able to build the strong, diverse collection that we'd like for this child and others. Our staff shared, there are some titles we would love to own to fill out our collection and based on requests from our residents. Examples include award winners, Newberry's, Caldecott's, and many new titles, but we are unable. Other challenges include the ability to maintain all books in a series when titles consistently have copies expiring and needing to be repurchased. Another consideration is the demand we hear from residents around wait time for e-books and e-audiobooks. Digital materials make up one-third of our collection, and we are actively spending valuable resources for e-materials, nearly half of our collection budget. However, even with this dedication of limited resources, we are experiencing 70-day, on average, wait times. In conclusion, please support House File 3698 to ensure fair ebook pricing, protect taxpayer dollars, restore local library control, and guarantee digital access for all Minnesotans. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. The third testifier who signed up in advance is Todd Hill. Ms. Hendren, if you could just stay in case there are questions for you, I'd appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Chair Freiberg and Chair Kwama, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of my client, the Association of American Publishers. I would draw your attention to the letter our client filed for this hearing, along with a letter from the News Media Alliance in opposition to House File 3698. On behalf of hundreds of thousands of authors and creators in Minnesota and across the country, as well as publishers, we oppose this legislation for three reasons. Because, number one, it would significantly harm readers in Minnesota. Secondly, it would undermine the rights of authors and publishers. And thirdly, threatens the viability of independent bookstores. Digital access has expanded how people read and listen to books. In addition to print books, publishers now offer the latest best-selling novels to libraries in digital formats that library patrons can now borrow instantly without having to visit a physical location. More patrons than ever before can access for free at the push of a button a record number of award-winning and best-selling literary works that they may otherwise have purchased from a bookseller. Under federal copyright law, authors and publishers hold the exclusive rights to their creative works. These rights include the authority to decide whether and when and how their works are reproduced, distributed, and licensed, including to libraries and other book markets like independent bookstores. This legislation attempts to take away these rights from authors and publishers and other creators, enabling the government to make decisions about creators' intellectual property instead of the creators themselves. Libraries receive multiple licenses from publishers that permit them to make ebooks available over and over again to their patrons at an aggregate cost that is far less per reader that would buy a personal license to purchase. I actually draw your attention to the chart that Representative Kwam was just asking about. And if you look at the chart on page 2, this chart shows that for an ebook that the libraries are on average paying $45 for that license, and an individual consumer is paying $15. The fact of the matter is that with that $45 is actually buying 26 individual licenses or uses. So the actual cost per license for the library is $1.73, not $45. And the same goes for the audiobooks. Again, using their suggestion that it's for 26 uses, that $60 audiobook license is actually $2.30. And to just go further onto the question that Representative Kwam had about the chart on page 5, if they in fact bought 835 copies, that would actually be 21,710 individual licenses that an individual consumer would be purchasing. And at the cost, if they paid the consumer rate, it would be $325,650 versus the $55,000 that they paid, according to this. So there is a significant savings of almost $270,000 to the libraries today. Libraries are already receiving digital books at a significantly reduced rate when compared to what you or I pay at retail. The likely impact of this legislation is that it will reduce rather than expand access to digital library materials in Minnesota. When publishers cannot meet the restricted demands of this legislation, libraries may lose access to new releases, experience higher cost, or be prohibited by the state from licensing ebooks and audiobooks altogether. It is for these reasons the groups who stand in opposition to this legislation include, among others, numerous authors, creators, book publishers, the 17,000 members of the Authors Guild, the American Booksellers Association, the News Media Alliance, and the Independent Book Publishers Association. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House Bill 3698 and stand for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. Vice Chair Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gottfried. So my question is, if I'm understanding this correctly, this is a compact that only goes into effect. It's with other states. And can you just tell us what a little bit about those other states and what other states are in it? I want to know a little bit more about, like, the population that's involved.
Representative Gottfried.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Altendorf. As was spoken by Ms. Hawkins here, Connecticut is the other one that would be involved in this particular compact. If there is a population of over 7 million that is hit, that is when these laws would go into effect.
Okay. Vice Chair Altendorf.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so as a follow-up, so we need to get to the 7 million. Minnesota would be the second state, and so just my math, that's going to put us over 7 million. That's only 3% of the U.S. population. So are you worried about, because that's such a small amount, that then the publishers will not sell e-books to those states because it's too difficult or they're not going to renegotiate? And so, you know, like, I understand, like, I'm hearing you have good intentions, and we're looking at what are the unintended consequences that are going to come down the road for Minnesota.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Actually, I think Ms. Hawkins has maybe a more specific answer than I do, and I think I may have misrepresented something, and I apologize for that. I will let Ms. Hawkins speak to this.
Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The 7 million population is outside of Minnesota. So Connecticut's bill is 7 million outside of Connecticut. We would be, you know, our percentage, plus we would need another state for Connecticut's to go into effect. We have done the same thing, 7 million outside of Minnesota. So we would need Connecticut and at least one other state to trigger the population. Also, there are other states that are considering this. There is... So New Jersey is about as far along as we are in this process. Iowa, Missouri, Hawaii, D.C., I believe, is considering it. So there are other states that are also pursuing this. The goal is for libraries nationally to sort of come around this issue.
Okay.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
One more. So, Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate the bill. The intention of it, I think, is, you know, you obviously want to drive down the cost for the libraries. I understand that. This is only my second term, and what I saw before you were elected was, like, when the government started getting involved with, like, the Uber-Lyft contracts, they threatened to pull out of Minnesota because those are private industries. And when things become very challenging, they are going to back out. And so I don't think this bill is ready. I don't think we want Minnesotans to not have access to e-books, which I'm afraid is the unintended consequences that's going to happen until this gets bigger, right? That's what, if there was a bigger compact that had more leverage, right now we're not there. We're so small that I am worried what would happen to Minnesota. And I do want a roll call, Mr. Chair, because I want on record who votes for this bill so that when the e-books are not available anymore, that we know.
Okay. A roll call has been requested, and a roll call shall be granted. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. A question that Mr. Hill brought up regarding the number of licensing and just the price per license. And as he break down in the graph that he showed us, it seems pretty reasonable cost to the libraries. Representative Gottfried, do you have a response to that? And the reason I ask that, it seems as though your intention is to bring the cost down, right, to the libraries. But according to the graph that Mr. Hill presented, they are of very good price and much lower than the consumer rate. Just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. And I appreciate the question because there's math behind this as well. So this chair leaned back a little bit too far. I apologize. But if you look at the cost of an ebook license, $45 was, I think, the average that was utilized here. That's good for 26 checkouts. That's one person that can check that out, you know, at a time, 26 times. I think it was quoted as $1.73. Now let's take the cost. Let's say take a high cost of a physical copy of a book, $20, let's say. And if you can rent circulate that book in perpetuity, maybe upwards of 70 times, that's 28 cents per checkout. And so when you do the math and actually break it down that way, it is significantly onerous. And I think there have been arguments made that I actually don't buy that e-books and regular books are fundamentally different. They're not. They start with Once Upon a Time, and they end with Happily Ever After, the same book would. So the content is the same. So, again, the question becomes, why are our public libraries, why are our taxpayer dollars for a physical copy paying 28 cents per checkout as opposed to $1.73 per checkout? That's my math behind it. And if it pleases the body, I would ask that Ms. Hawkins could add anything that she would like.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing I would just add to that is that the consumer, when they do purchase it, they do get to keep it in perpetuity, right? So they are being able to keep that. They own it, whereas for us it is a lease, it's a rental. So that's sort of a distinguishing there in that as well. It's something that they're purchasing. We're licensing it for that cost.
Thank you. Chair McDonald, any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, yeah, just follow up. When you said for us it's a... What do you mean, who's the us in your statement? The libraries?
Correct. Mm-hmm. The libraries would be leasing that.
Yeah.
Chair McDonald?
No further questions, Your Honor.
Representative Coulter?
Some of us aren't attorneys and we're glad. Just thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few sort of questions first. First, I think a question for the author. There was a concern raised that this bill might violate federal copyright law. Could someone, Representative Godfrey, or someone explain that?
Representative Godfrey.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter. Appreciate that question. And I will also give Ms. Hawkins an opportunity to respond to this as well. But my understanding is this would not be a violation of federal copyright law. If you look at other states where similar legislation has struggled, it is because they tried to directly regulate the publishers under the chapter of copyright law. What this does is simply enforce our own contracts. I think of it like this. Say the government is a business, and we have multiple business agents, procurement agents that are getting fleeced by a middleman. We go to those procurement agents and we say, hey, these are now the contracts that you are allowed to enter into if you're going to, you know, maintain, employment at this business. In our terms, if you're going to be receiving public dollars, taxpayer dollars. And so that's what we're doing. Essentially, what we are telling our procurement agents, saying, like, hey, listen, we need you to have better deals. And so this isn't a direct regulation under copyright law of any authors. It is not trying to infringe on any sort of copyright law. What we're trying to do is make sure that we are using taxpayer dollars as wisely as possible. And if Ms. Hawkins would like to add anything to that, I would allow her to do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Godfrey hit the nail on the head on that one.
Sure. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think my next question is probably for Ms. Hawkins. I'm looking at the bill. I'm looking at subdivision 3, and I'm seeing contact requirements that prohibiting contact requirements that would prohibit the library from loaning through an interlibrary loan system, or restricts the number of times the library may loan material, or restricts the duration, and so on. I mean, are there similar restrictions on sort of traditional printed material that libraries have? Like that, okay, the head shaking is good enough. Like I can't imagine that you'd buy a copy of a book and say, oh, but we can only loan this out 10 times. Like that's not how this works. So thank you, that's helpful. I just sort of in closing, I will go on the record and say I am unabashedly pro-public library. Ms. Hendren, one, I think, critical constituency that you left out of folks who depend on electronic materials is parents of young children going on long road trips. I cannot tell you how audiobooks have saved mine and my wife's sanity on long road trips. And, I mean, I think, again, we're talking about public libraries. These are public resources. And I think they should be treated as such. So I am again proudly pro public library. So much so, in fact, that I'm going to sign on to this bill as soon as I'm done talking. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is just for Mr. Hill. I would like to hear your opinion about possible federal copyright problems.
Mr. Hill.
Yes, Chair Freeberg and Representative Davis. for the record, I'm not an attorney, and nor did I stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. So I'm venturing into waters that I want to be careful. But it is my understanding, and I think that there's two issues here. One, copyright law and licensing, federal law is very clear that authors and creators and publishers of these creations control them. They get to determine the price. They get to determine how they are released, the format they're released, and the terms and conditions for that. That is the author's and the creator's right. It is true a number of other states have passed bills trying to get at this issue in a little bit different way, and those bills have been found to be unconstitutional. The governor of New York vetoed a bill and didn't allow it to go into effect because of a ruling in Maryland. This bill has not been challenged. I believe, based on some of the letters that have been submitted, that will likely happen. But at this point, the law has not gone into effect, so nobody's been harmed, and there's nobody to bring forward a case. But I do believe that this bill, while just saying we're talking about a different section of law, is still trying to impact how creators can determine their works are released. And that's what copyright law does and protects.
Representative Davis?
Okay, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Mr. Hill. Yeah, so, and that was going to be my second question, was to get your opinion as not an attorney, that there potentially could be a federal lawsuit coming, but I'd certainly, and maybe he doesn't need to because he kind of already addressed it, but would want to give Representative Gottfried the opportunity to speak again on that if he feels it's necessary.
Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Davis. No, this is a good question because it really does matter what chapter of law that we're trying to work through here. And if you look through the judge's opinion of the Maryland law that was struck down, it really talks about, you know, who's entitled to whom and things like that. And we are entitled to determine what our publicly funded entities can, the contracts that they can enter into. That is our right as a state government. When we give state dollars, taxpayer dollars, to publicly funded libraries, it is well within our rights to say, these are the contracts that you are allowed to enter in. Now, you know, Mr. Hill is correct. Like, the publishers can choose not to enter into those contracts. That is correct. I do want to point out one thing, though, that I think both addresses may be a concern here, as well as a concern of Representative Altendorf about, you know, all of a sudden e-books becoming unavailable within this state if we were to pass this law, is if you look at the actual provisions and the sort of contracts that we try to tell our procurement agents, if you will, to use that metaphor, that they cannot enter into, we say nothing about price. There's nothing in here that says you cannot enter a contract with a vendor or a distributor if it is over a certain price. And I think that is very, very prescient and important for this discussion, because if we're talking about free market economics that we're talking about right here, I think a very logical step would be to increase the price of audiobooks, ebooks that we would receive a contract for. But at the same time, I think that is a cost that we are willing to take on if these other conditions are met within a particular contract, because it means that we could continue to provide greater accessibility for, and ultimately in the long run, to a wider array of people, and for ultimately a better price for the taxpayer in the long run. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I do have three members on the list, and we do have five more bills to get to, so any brevity you could provide would be appreciated. Also, the motion is to send this to the Commerce Committee, so discussions about issues like contract law might be a little more appropriate for that committee. But with that, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Mr. Hill, just to clarify, because I heard you say that you're speaking on behalf of publishers, authors, and creators. Does the Association of American Publishers represent authors and creators?
Mr. Hill.
Chair Freiberg and Representative Greenman, we do not, but I have been given the authority to present their letters on their behalf, and we did have a letter from the Authors Guild and from the Independent Publishing Coalition, but those did not make it in time for the deadline today.
Okay.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I think it's important here, because when I think about who is standing up, not just for authors, but for readers, it is the librarians in our community. It is the folks who dedicate their lives to ensuring that we have access to all types of creative content. And what I know about the publishing industry right now is authors and creators are making less and less and less, not because of libraries, but because of the consolidation in the publishing community and places like Amazon that are extracting more and more and more. And I think that that's an important context here, because when we ask the question of who's speaking for the public and the taxpayers, it's not the publishers, right? It should be all of us. And I just to point out and sort of respond to, I guess, a few of what I've heard across the aisle, but start with the author. You know, why, for a copy of a book, would you be paying 28 cents per checkout and a dollar plus for a digital copy? The answer is because they can. They figured out that they can. And government is a profit center, like they're a profit center in healthcare. And we talk about this in every committee. And so I think that when we look at this, we actually have to look at it in the context of what we're talking about every committee, which is corporate power, concentrated corporate power. And I know folks on both sides of the aisle really care about this. We see in this some of the unfair business practice they're using, NDAs. We talked about the use of NDAs by corporations, a different kind of business, but they're all, I mean, Amazon is actually a tech company, but NDAs, unfair licensing agreements. And so if we're going to take this actually what the actual problem that's being raised to us, we got to look at that. And the last thing I'll say, because I think the idea that we're at the mercy of corporate power and thus we should do what they want, Uber, we want to make sure that riders and drivers are treated fairly, but Uber threatens to pull out, so we should do what they want. We actually passed the bill, and you know what happened? Uber's still here. The idea that here we should change our policy or not stand up for taxpayers and readers because the consolidated publishing company says we might pull out, like, that's not our job. Our job is to stand up and say, we are going to stand up for taxpayers, we're going to stand up for readers. We are not at the mercy of the corporate publishing industry. And the last thing I'll say, because I really appreciate this bill, Representative Gottfried, and I really appreciate you bringing the librarians in, because they are the backbone of what we are all doing here, but is when I hear unintentional consequences, it usually means that somebody is sticking up for the big consolidated corporate power at the expense of Minnesotans, because it usually means that there's not. So I really hope folks are looking at what is actually happening, which is we are trying to give our libraries, our taxpayers, and our readers a little more control so that they have a little more access, the same way we do with print, in this increasingly consolidated digital market. So thank you for this bill, and this will be an easy vote, and I'm glad, Representative Altendorf, you asked for a roll call, because it'll show which side folks are on, the corporations or our readers and our taxpayers.
Representative Roach.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate what the author's trying to do, but I just feel like the framing of this is, for lack of a better term, a little bit disingenuous. This isn't about access. The kids have access. It's the fact that when I read in here, you know, page 5 of the slide, it doesn't say that readers can't. It says that readers have to wait. What's wrong with waiting? You know what it does? It actually opens up kids to another book that they can get that they otherwise maybe wouldn't have got. And at the end of the day, the free market allows you to purchase it if you'd like. So if you're one of those readers that just can't wait, purchase it. Nothing's stopping you from getting it on Amazon or Apple or any other app that you can get it and digitally get it for very, very cheap. So I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I just think the whole the framing of it is a little disingenuous, and I'm going to pass on this.
Thank you. Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Greenman, and I think Representative Gottfried has really kind of expressed it well. I don't see this as any different than, say, going out for a street improvement project and negotiating a better price. Libraries don't operate in a free market system. The East Central Regional Library, which covers the area that I'm from, they get $1 million from the state, to just about $1 million, 23% of their budget, $2.5 million from member counties, so that's about 60% of their budget. And nothing you know, we have an obligation to protect taxpayers. I believe that 100%. And we're not talking about, you know, restricting publishers' contracts that they can sign or requiring publishers to sell with us. We're just restricting the contracts that our libraries can enter into. When we're talking about government dollars and government contracts, I think we have an obligation to protect the taxpayers. And like Representative Gottfried said, nothing in this bill dictates the price that they're ultimately going to pay. So that's where I stand on it.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, I do have one question, though.
Sure.
Todd, you had mentioned the viability of independent bookstores being questioned in here, and I'm not seeing anything that would affect independent bookstores, but if you could maybe clarify that.
Mr. Hill.
Chair Freeburg, Representative Gordon. A couple things. It is a very delicate ecosystem. We have many people to answer to. Libraries are a very important part of the market for us. They're very important to us. But so are the bookstores that sell books. And one of the concerns that the authors and the publishers have is if you grant libraries unlimited numbers of licenses to books and make more and more books available for free, less people are going to go to the bookstore and purchase those books. And that is a challenge. And that goes back to the pricing model as well. And we have seen when we make more new releases available in formats that are free, it does cannibalize the bookstores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there are some gaps in this bill. I have concerns about that. And I have concerns about the calculations you're quoting about real books because, you know, frankly, there's a cost of staff. There's more to it than the price of the book. Frankly, e-books are like a bookmobile without having to pay the gas. It's easier for people in the rural areas to get it and others that can't get out of the house. There's quite a bit of a access improvement, but just the overhead and et cetera does add a cost to the other books. I don't think this is ready for prime time. I will support moving it to Commerce, where I hope they work on it. But, you know, from the lack of clarity in the slides and for the actual content, I think there's work that needs to be done. So I will be supporting moving it to Commerce, but I don't see anything that makes me think this is ready for prime time.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Sorry about that. Chair McDonald, did you have a short follow-up?
Yeah, I was going to pass, but since you called me, just real quickly, short follow-up.
You don't have to. Just think of it as a St. Patrick's Day
I was
present.
Not filibustering the House floor today. St. Patrick's Day privilege, Representative Gottfried. Just quickly, I think we can all appreciate the duty and what your application is of the bill. My only thought is, at what point do we stop? I mean, we certainly can regulate. Maybe we should include in here that libraries work on their contract with the janitorial services or with XL Energy or with the building owner. I mean, I think at one point you got to give the credence to their libraries to be able to work with their contracts, certainly save the taxpayers' dollars, but why not then work the past legislation that they have to strike a better contract with their janitorial services or their heating and air conditioning, their Excel, their building rental. I think at one point we just need to let the local control be what that is, a local control. That's my only thoughts on your bill.
Thank you, Chair McDonald. Representative Gottfried, you're welcome to respond to that as part of your closing remarks.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And actually, we do have an answer for you, Representative Quam, from one of your previous questions, if the Chair would allow us to quick answer that.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the money that we invested last year purchasing that author's titles for $55,000, there were 11,343 circulations on those titles last year.
Thank you. And Representative Gottfried, your closing
Thank
remarks.
You, Mr. Chair. Well, folks, no, I appreciate the vibrant discussion today. And one, I will say that this really is about corporate consolidation. Let's be real. There are, I believe, five publishers that are proving to be a problem. Five. And that's a problem. We're talking about a once vibrant industry that had many, 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 many publishers that could get their content out, promote authors, and now we're down to five. So this really is them exerting their market power and trying to use government as their profit mark. And we have the ability to stand up and say, no, no, we can enter into fair contracts with you. And so I would say that we do need to stand up for taxpayers in this regard. I understand the concerns about, you know, the compact and there being enough. There will be enough. There will be enough. There will be more states entering into this agreement because it is a problem. And to Representative McDonald's point, this is something that our libraries are asking for. You know, they are asking for our help with this. They are asking for our help with their budgets. They are asking for our help trying to take care of their constituents, our taxpayers, and I think we owe them that. So I look forward to seeing the results of the roll call. Sounds like it's going to be an exciting vote. And with that, I would ask all members to please vote yes. Thank you.
With that, I will renew the motion to recommend to re-refer House File 3698 to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Freiberg?
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Chair Quam?
Very reluctantly, yes.
Quam, aye. Vice Chair Lee?
Yes.
Lee, aye. Vice Chair Altendorf?
No.
Altendorf, no. Representative Akam?
Yes.
Akam, aye. Representative Coulter?
Very unreluctantly, aye.
Coulter, aye. Representative Davis?
Very heartbroken, no.
Davis, no. Representative Gordon?
Yes.
Gordon, aye. Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative McDonald?
Aye. I don't
even know. McDonald, no. Representative Roach? Roach, no. Representative Vernick?
Aye.
Vernick, aye. Mr. Chair, there are 8 ayes and 4 nays.
There being 8 ayes, 4 nays, and a variety of emotions expressed, the bill is on its way. With that, I will... Congratulations, Representative Gottfried. With that, I will turn the gavel over to Vice Chair.
Thank you, members.
Hey, we'll see you in Commerce. All right, I got to run that. Yeah. I got to run that. That went far longer than I thought.
Yep.
Okay, so while Chair Freiberg is getting ready, I'm going to move House File 4243 in front of the committee. And then Chair Freiberg, whenever you're ready, to your bill.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I'm just waiting for my computer went to sleep, so it has my notes and such. So. So, I will move House File 4243. So, just a little before I make the motion. So, there you might notice there are 5 bills here. I got a few agency bills kind of late in the process, and I just decided to put my name on all of them and drop them. You might notice that they are all consecutively numbered. So, I thought it might be good just to try to get through as many of them as we could today. So, the first. One is the, I will move, and I'm, I know Co-Chair Quam and I have had some scheduling challenges, so we haven't totally discussed thoroughly all of the motions that will be made and so forth, but I think as we saw from that last committee discussion, having some spontaneity in the committee and not knowing what's actually going to happen makes things exciting. So I might make some motions, I might withdraw them and change them depending on how the discussion goes, So the first bill, it's House File 4243. I'll move to put it before the committee, and maybe just to make things exciting to start off with, I'll move it to the general register and see how things go.
Okay, Chair Freiberg moves House File 4243 to be referred to the general register. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a series of technical changes. brought forward by the campaign finance board. And I still don't quite have my notes loaded up yet, so maybe I will just turn it over to Director Sigurdsson to present a summary of the bill.
Director Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson, Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As Chair Freiberg mentioned, this is basically the legislative recommendations from the board to clean up some provisions in Chapter 10A. With one possible exception, I don't think you're going to find any policy here. This is just cleaning up the chapter so it's easier to administer. The first section is a change to the definition of metropolitan governmental unit, where we divide out or separate out seven counties in the metro area in cities with a population of over 50,000 in the metro area from that definition. That was necessary because of the change in the lobbying provisions that were put in place last year. It causes an internal conflict to how that works if a city with a population of over 50,000 is both a metropolitan governmental unit and a political subdivision. So to clean up that problem in the lobbying provision, that definition is changed. Then you have sections 2, 3, 4, and 6, and 7 that kind of reflect that change, because currently under statute, local officials who work for a county in the metro area or a city, again, with a population of over 50,000 in the metro area, are covered by the conflict of interest statute and are also covered by the requirement to file an economic interest statement with their local political subdivision. And so we need to reinsert in those sections language for those entities back in so that it still applies. I want to emphasize that that's not expanding either the economic interest statement or the conflict of interest statement. Those entities are already included. This is just specifying that because of the change in the first definition, we're bringing them back in and leaving them basically as status quo. Section 5, I did want to mention for a moment, the board's role with non-elected public officials who still have to file an economic interest statement is to contact them after they have been appointed and notify them that within 60 days they have to file an economic interest statement, typically with the board. This also applies to candidates who are filing for office. They're notified when they file that they need to file with the board an economic interest statement within 14 days of the close of the filing period. But in some cases, we need to contact those individuals to make sure that they comply and make them aware that, one, it's a requirement, and two, there are late filing fees if they don't meet that requirement. But we have no way of contacting them because we don't have their street address necessarily. Prior to, unfortunately, the events of the past summer, typically we would receive a street address for those individuals. Now the Secretary of State and other appointing authorities are reluctant to provide us the street address, and some county officials have indicated that they're not sure they can give us the affidavit of filing for office because there's another provision in 204B06 that classifies that as private data and are not sure that they can give that to the board. This is clarifying that regardless of that provision, we can receive that information on street address so that we can contact these individuals so that they don't, because of the lack of contact, find themselves facing late filing fees for their economic interest statement. Section 8, this is 8 and 9, 10 and 11 really all kind of fall into the same heading. Starting in 2025, just last year, political committees and funds that make contributions to local level candidates need to file with the board. They register with the board and file reports with the board. But some of the statutes regulating the activity of those political committees wasn't updated to reflect local candidates. For example, Section 8 is talking about independent expenditures. We have several provisions that talk about what is or is not an independent expenditure, what is or is not a coordinated activity. That's sections 9, 10, and 11, And because of that, it doesn't really apply. It doesn't help the regulated community understand what they can and cannot do in terms of independent expenditures for local candidates. It makes it more difficult for the board to administer those provisions. So this is basically modifying it to add local candidates to those coordination statutes. Section 8 is doing that for earmarking of a contribution. Currently, it's prohibited for a individual to give a contribution to a political committee and say, please give that to this particular candidate because that's a way around contribution limits. But again, it currently only applies to state-level candidates, so we just want to extend that to make sure it applies to local candidates as well. Sections 12 and 15 are clarifying, or actually, frankly, making coherent the filing schedule for special elections. When a special election is called because of, you know, it, obviously you don't know when it's going to be called, it's all based on when the writ of election is issued by the governor. There are two problems, especially if the special election period is called at the end of one calendar year and extends into the following calendar year. Frankly, Chapter 10A doesn't deal with that scenario at all well. So this is providing a clarification. In Section 12 is dealing with special elections that are held in conjunction with a state election. And Section 15 is providing clarification on filing of reports for special elections when the special election is not held in conjunction with a state election. In both cases, one addition that is being created here is that there's sometimes a gap between when the special election, everyone knows there's going to be a special election, and when the writ is issued, and sometimes you see committees quickly formed and raise large amounts of money to use at the special election. The problem is that because the filing period currently starts with the writ, you never know about that activity until the end of the year. This would change that and create basically an additional report to show the activity that occurred a certain number of days before the issue of the writ, and that should provide for additional disclosure of the activity in those special elections. Section 13 is closing a small gap. The committees and funds and party units that spend over $200 on a local candidate or a local ballot question have to file reports in an odd numbered year, up to five reports. There is a small gap where an in-kind contribution made from one committee to another committee for the purpose of influencing a ballot question or to make independent expenditures was not covered. And so we did have some committees that didn't have a report, even though they clearly were making in-kind contributions for the purpose of influencing those elections. So this is just closing that gap in the statute. Section 14. Section 14 is cleaning up a lot of, and this is just kind of awkward language that's ended up in 10A20 over the years. 10A20 specifies all of the schedules that you have in your reports, in reports filed by candidates and reports filed by political committees and funds. But sometimes changes in other parts of 10A have not been reflected in chapter in 10A20. For example, contributions to ballot question committees only have to be itemized if they're over $500 as opposed to over $200 for everybody else. That wasn't reflected in that particular provision, so we're just clarifying the language, cleaning up the language, but I want to emphasize there are no new requirements for you or for anyone else. This is just cleaning up the language so it's easier to understand. Section 16, this is a little bit more complicated. Candidates who do not sign a public subsidy agreement and who raise specified thresholds of contributions or expenditures have to notify the board and notify the candidates who did sign for the same office, who did sign the public subsidy agreement, that they've passed those thresholds. And the reason that's required is because then the candidate who did sign the public subsidy agreement has the option of being released from the spending limit. In other words, if you sign a public subsidy agreement and your opponent doesn't and they raise a very large amount of money, you have the option of being released from the spending limit. The problem is that there's no, while there are timelines set up in statute for that to occur, there is no penalty if the candidate who did not sign the agreement never provides you with that notification or provides the board for that notification. So this is establishing a late filing fee so that there is some motivation here and at least some penalty if there's any gamesmanship being done there by not providing notification. Section 17 provides a penalty for both independent expenditure committees, provides a requirement that independent expenditure committees and ballot question committees file an underlying disclosure statement within a certain time frame. It currently provides a penalty for an independent expenditure committee that doesn't do that, but by simple omission, ballot questions were not included. And so this is just, again, filling up that gap so that ballot question committees also have to file that or face a late filing fee. And then Section 18, this is the multi-candidate party expenditure. Certain types of expenditures can be made by party units that don't count towards the spending limit. The sample ballot is the one that most people know. That's not a contribution to any candidate that's listed on the ballot, even if they're perfectly aware of the sample ballot. We have found that party units want to use some of the provisions in there, for example, for fundraising, for local candidates that they're supporting. This would modify it so that local candidates could also be one of the three candidates that are required before you can claim a multi-candidate expenditure. And Madam Chair, I know I went over that very fast, but these are, again, fairly dry items. Obviously, happy to answer any questions that there may be.
Thank you, Director. Chair Freiberg, anything to add?
I think that was pretty thorough.
Okay. So just checking to see if there are any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill. Okay, so seeing none, we'll move to member discussion if there are any questions. Okay, well, Chair Freiberg, I don't know if you want to.
No, I think these are common sense cleanup language. I appreciate the members' consideration, and I will renew my motion that House File, which one are we on? 4243 be referred to the General Register.
Okay. So all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the General Register. Okay, so moving for us today is House File 4241. Chair Freiberg.
I think 4239 was next. That's the other.
Oh, sorry. You know what? I crossed. Yes. My apologies. Chair Freiberg moves House File 4239. For the
and I will move that this one be recommended to be laid over. I'm a little less confident on this one.
Okay.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill was also brought to me by the Campaign Finance Board. It makes changes to disclaimer language, mostly as the result of litigation. Once again, I think it makes sense for Director Sigurdsson to provide some background on this, hopefully pretty briefly. There is an amendment also, which we can maybe it makes sense to have the background on the bill first because the amendment is slightly different topic.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, it's similar.
Yeah, however you want to do it. So, yeah, why don't we do a summary of House File 4239 and then, and then move, if that's all,
Madam Chair, committee members, just real brief background here so we're all using a term the same way. Grassroots lobbying is a specific type of lobbying. It's where the message isn't to you as a public official, rather it's to the public where the advertisement, for example, would say contact your legislator and ask them to vote for or against a particular bill or contact the governor and ask them to veto a bill, something like that. So the communication, again, is to the public rather than to the public official. Under current statute, lobbyist principals that engage in grassroots lobbying are required to disclose advertisements of over $2,000 that lists the vendor for the grassroots lobbying, lists their address, the amount spent with the vendor, and then the particular issue that the grassroots lobbying advertisement was for. That provision was challenged in U.S. District Court by the Minnesota Right to Life and Minnesota Gun Rights Associations on the grounds that that providing disclosure on the vendors that they did business with would or in some cases has led to harassment of the vendors that they deal business with. And then the vendors are less willing or in some cases not willing to do business with them going forward. The court also had problems with the way in which that particular provision was gathering the information, namely that if the benefit is to the public to know about the expenditures or who's doing grassroots lobbying, then it shouldn't be at a report that's filed the year after it occurs. It should be occurring in some other manner. The district court then issued Well, on October 25th, 2025, the district court granted the plaintiffs temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction preventing the board from enforcing this reporting provision for reports filed by the plaintiffs, although pretty clearly it would also apply to any plaintiff or to any lobbyist principal. The board did have a long series of conversations with the Office of the Attorney General, who of course represents the board in court, and came to the conclusion that it's very unlikely that the state would prevail if this went to a full trial. You may recall that in First Amendment issues, and this is a First Amendment issue, that if you lose, then the plaintiff has the right to require the state to pay for all their legal fees. At this point, believing that there is not a way forward to defend that particular statute, and with the belief that it would be best to limit financial responsibility of the state on this issue, the board believes it's best to simply eliminate this requirement, which is what you see in Section 1 of 4239. That's simply being repealed. And the effective date is the date following final enactment to basically stop the clock on legal fees as soon as possible. However, the court did not deny or argue that there is value in providing disclosure to the public on who is making grassroots lobbying advertisements to try to influence their actions. And with that in mind, the board instead is placing forward this language, which is creating a disclaimer for lobbying material. Currently in Minnesota statute, there are no disclaimer requirements for lobbying material of any type. This, I want to emphasize, is limited only to grassroots lobbying material. Again, that which is directed towards the public. If, for example, if a lobbyist provides you with a white paper on a lobbying material, it doesn't have to say prepared and paid for at the bottom. But if you have a billboard or a radio advertisement or a TV advertisement where you're asking the public to take an action to affect policy, then the board believes it would be appropriate to have a disclaimer. There are some important limitations here. It will address the issue of if this is adopted, it will provide the disclosure to the public when the advertisement occurs, which will allow them to evaluate it more quickly. It only applies, again, to grassroots lobbying. It does not apply when the communication or the advertisement is between an association and its membership. So membership organizations can still tell its members, you know, please contact your legislator and ask them to do X, and that's not going to trigger this requirement because we don't want to try to get between a member association and its membership. Additionally, it does not apply to associations that are not a lobbyist principal, which is basically a financial threshold. If you're not represented by a lobbyist or you haven't spent over $50,000 in a calendar year on grassroots lobbying, then you're not a principal. So an individual who puts up a sign saying call the school board and tell them not to raise the levy or whatever it may be, that this isn't going to suddenly apply to that individual. This is only for, again, organizations that are spending much more on advertisement. The Section 2 also has a fairly lengthy discussion of how the size of the disclaimer and how long it has to be on a TV screen or a radio advertisement. All of that is going to be covered again in Section 3, and I'm going to cover that material because it's identical in Section 3. Madam Chair, this Section 2 is rather different than Section 3 in terms of the basis, so perhaps I could stop there and see if there are questions before I go into Section 3.
I don't think I have anyone with questions, so I think we can just move forward. Yeah.
Okay. And then Section 3 is dealing with campaign signs under 211B04. The current statute requires that disclaimers on outdoor signs be prominent, and the board interpreted that to mean just being visible and legible. A complaint filed with the board was dismissed basically because there was a disclaimer on the sign. Yes, it was small, but if you walked up to the sign, you could read it, so therefore it was visible and legible. The Court of Appeals looked at that decision determined that that was incorrect and that really prominent means it has to be conspicuous and readily noticeable. With all due respect to the court, the board isn't much more sure how to determine what prominently is versus conspicuous, and it believes that it would be best for the legislature to weigh in with a set of standards on what the outdoor sign disclaimer size should be, not only for the board's use in trying to determine if a violation occurred, but more importantly for your use, for the regulated community, because this way you'll have a clean standard. The printer will always know how large the font has to be, and there's going to be a lot less questions on that area. There are other requirements here dealing with how long it has to be displayed on a television advertisement. That's copying what's the current requirement in the FCC. The same with the radio advertisement, having to have clear and volume and speed that can be easily understood. That's from the FCC. Again, trying to put standards that I think are going to be a lot easier for the regulated community to comply with.
Great. Thank you, Director Secretson. Chair Freiberg?
I guess maybe if you want to ask if anyone else would like to testify.
Sure. Okay. So just for clarity, in case folks are curious, so I think we're not offering the A1 anymore.
Yeah, if you'd like to turn to that. There was an amendment prepared. It had been part of a previous bill. I don't need to offer it. I might want to consult with co-chair Quam, because I believe I made the motion to lay this over. Assuming the amendment is not offered, co-chair Quam, would you be amenable to me withdrawing that motion and moving to send this bill to the general register?
Chair Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, because of the discussion we had directly with the Campaign Finance Board on the language, that I would vote to move this.
Okay. So Chair Freiberg amends his motion to lay the bill over to now re-refer House File 4239 to the General Register. Is that your motion?
Correct.
Okay. All right, so now that we have addressed that, we're going to move to see if any members of the public would like to testify on this bill before we move to member discussion. Okay, so seeing none, we'll move to member discussion if there's anyone who'd like to speak on the bill. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Chair. In the bill, I heard you, in your testimony, I heard you elicit Minnesota gun rights and Minnesota right to life. Were they contacted to be able to testify at all in regards to the language cleanup that was solicited their name?
Well, I guess Chair Freiberg. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Roach, for the question. I did not reach out to anybody. I mean, this bill has been noticed through the regular process, and I know those organizations do have representatives who track pretty closely what's following. So this bill's been out there for a little while, and I know this issue's been discussed. And this bill is in an attempt to conform to language that decision led to. I'm assuming they are aware that the bill is was noticed.
Representative Roach? Okay, great. Any further discussion from members? Okay, Chair Freiberg, closing.
Thank you. I think this will clear up some ambiguity in the law, and I'd encourage members' support. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4239 be referred to the General Register.
So Chair Freiberg moves that House File 4239 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. Okay, House File 4239 is be referred to the General Register. Okay, so before us now is House File 4241. Chair Freiberg.
Yep. Thank you. So. And at least to start with, I will move to refer House File 4241 to the General Register.
Okay, to your bill, Chair Freiberg.
Thank you. So county boards in Minnesota have the authority to select and appoint a medical examiner, except in Hennepin County. By law, the Hennepin County Board must impanel a separate medical examiner board to evaluate and recommend applicants for appointment. The membership of the Medical Examiner Board includes individuals with specialized training and knowledge who are uniquely positioned within the medical and forensic community. The problem which House File 4241 seeks to remedy is that existing language mandates that the panel be filled from professional organizations that do not exist, such as the Minnesota Society of Pathologists. The proposed language specific to selection of the Hennepin County Medical Examiner updates the board membership to include qualified representatives from the University of Minnesota Medical School, Hennepin Healthcare, and the Medical Examiner's Office. So are you available for questions, or did you want to testify specifically?
I'm available for both. I do have some prepared remarks.
So okay. With that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Yeah, well, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Sean Wilson. I'm the Director of Operations for the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. Since its inception in 1964, Hennepin County has had only three chief medical examiners. Dr. Andrew Baker, the chief medical examiner since 2004, was on staff and appointed only through the personal recommendation of his predecessor. No medical examiner board, just a board hearing. In fact, to our knowledge, no medical examiner has ever been appointed using the process currently outlined in statute. In 2006, when Chapter 390 underwent a major overhaul, that language, apparently a holdover from another section of statute, made the cut without much consideration or content validation. Although the anticipation of the inevitable retirement of Dr. Baker is the impetus for this current action, the flawed language has been a known issue for many years. A couple of questions should come to mind at this point. Why is Hennepin County different? Why, if no chief medical examiner has been selected using this process, why should we continue to perpetuate it? The answer is simple. Medical examiners and coroners are not created equal. Coroners can be elected, whereas medical examiners are appointed. In that 2006 revision, Section 390.011 established that medical examiners were independent county officials. In the absence of an independent vetting of a candidate's qualifications by a medical examiner board with specialized knowledge, the appointee may be underqualified or incompetent, or the appointment be viewed in bias or subject to a quid pro quo, any of which would inherently risk the neutrality and independence of the chief medical examiner. Hennepin County provides death investigation to one in every three Minnesotans. I'm going to say that again, one in every three Minnesotans. We are home to two level one trauma centers, the only burn unit and hyperbaric chamber in the region, Children's Hospital, which translates to more trauma victims, high profile and complicated investigations. The three chiefs that I mentioned previously held the distinction of being the president of our National Association of Medical Examiners, and Dr. Gary Peterson drafted the standards by which all medical examiners in the country are measured. Updating the language not only establishes a viable process for the selection of Dr. Baker's successor, but continues to ensure that Hennepin County will uphold the highest standards of death investigation free from outside influence. Thank you.
Thank you. And then Chair Freiberg, I guess, do you want to do the amendments now or?
I guess maybe see if there's anyone from the public okay. wants to testify, then we can do the
okay,
amendments.
And then we'll go to that. Okay, sure. Are there any members of the public here who would like to testify on the bill? Okay, we'll see none. Back to you, Chair Freiberg.
Yep, thank you. And just a little background here. So I have two amendments prepared, and then one actually has a secondary amendment that doesn't meet the deadline, and I'm happy to discuss that with Chair Quam here. They seemed like straightforward local issues, and I wasn't sure a full hearing on them was necessary. If it's the committee's preference, I can certainly try to squeeze that in the one time I have a gavel next week also. But last session, I know we had a bill that included several of these local issues kind of into a local government minibus. I thought that approach worked well. The two amendments I have prepared aren't related to the Hennepin County Medical Examiner, but they are kind of discrete local issues. Just with that as background, I don't know if any of the committee members have thoughts about that, or I can just go ahead and move the A1 amendment if that's members' preference. I'm seeing some nodding. So how about I just go ahead and move the A1
amendment? Let's move the A1.
So the A1 amendment deals with Rochester schools. A 1974 special law treats at-large seats on the Rochester School Board as distinct parallel contests. The vast majority of school districts statewide use a traditional at-large standard system. Sorry, you probably didn't think we'd be talking about this, but welcome to the legislature before deadline, where voters select multiple candidates from a single pool. The Rochester School Board unanimously approved a resolution to change the system. I've discussed this with Co-Chair Quam. There is also an A3 amendment, which came to us very late. It does not meet deadline. So, Co-Chair Quam, I don't know if you have thoughts about the A3 amendment. I'm getting a suggestion just to go ahead with it. So I think Chair, Co-Chair Quam is okay waiving the deadline. So I will move the A3 amendment to the A1 amendment.
Okay. So we're on the A3, and I think that was like passed out to members. I don't think they were in the packets, in case you're looking for your copy. Yeah. So Chair Farberg, do you want to explain the A3?
Yeah, it just it changes some language. Like I said, it was a late request from the Rochester School Board. It just described it. I mean, it just kind of reiterates that the district can alter its organization. So right now they use kind of an alley system, whereas most school districts in the state have at-large elections for more than one seat. So this just conforms the language.
Okay. Is there discussion on the A3? Okay. Well, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so the A1 is amended with the A3. And now we are back on the A1 as amended. Any discussion on the A1 as amended by the A3? Okay, so all in favor of the A1 as amended by the A3, say aye.
Aye.
Or, well, no, we have to adopt this. Yeah. Any opposed to the A1 as amended by the A3? Okay. So House File 4241 is amended with the A1 as amended by the A3. And now to the A1, or pardon, to the A2.
Yep, the A2 deals with Three Rivers Park District. The language was brought to me by Hennepin County. It just requires candidates for Three Rivers Park Commissioner to file a statement of economic interest similar to what we file.
Okay, is there discussion on the A2? Okay, so all in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the A2 is adopted. Well, now to the bill as amended, Chair Freiberg.
Thanks. I think it makes sense to update the Hennepin County Medical Examiner statutes, particularly when the language is obsolete. I think the other two changes that we added in also make sense. And am I doing my closing, or are we doing members?
Yes, let's open it up for member discussion in case anyone wants to talk about it as amended. Okay, we'll see you on closing.
Yep, what I just said. With that, great. I will renew my motion that House File 4241 as amended be referred to the General Register.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, Chair Freiberg renews his motion to re-refer House File 4241 as amended to the General Register. The motion prevails. So now, members, before us is House File 4242.
Thank you. I will move to lay over House File 4242 unless I get a contradictory signal from my GOP counterparts. And I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Chair Quam, did you want to...
Madam Chair, I did have, I think there needs more discussion at the distribution of the funds and clarity, so I think a layover would be appropriate.
Okay. Chair Freiberg, to your bill.
Yep, thank you. So I will move to layover House File 4242. So for more than a century, medical examiners and coroners have been required to dispose of a decedent's property through a public auction. For decades, the macabre spectacle drew large crowds and was reported on by local newspaper publications. This bill seeks to update the language and provide more modern, sensible solutions to the handling and disposition of personal effects on unclaimed or unidentified bodies long ago buried or cremated. The bill also enables the medical examiner to recover reasonable costs and limiting exposure to frivolous claims in the future. The proposed language offers medical examiners and coroners around the state a pragmatic approach to address this issue, allowing for individual circumstances to be considered for each decedent. The language in the bill was peer-reviewed by representatives from the Hennepin, Ramsey, Midwest, Anoka, and Southern Regional or Mayo Medical Examiner's Office, which combined to provide medico-legal death investigation for 74 of the 87 Minnesota counties. And Mr. Wilson is here again to speak to this bill as well.
Great. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members, thank you again. I would just like to add, of those 74 of the 87 counties, that represents 96% of the state's population. For this bill, I'd like to take you back in a time machine to 1911. Dr. Gilbert Seashore, the then Hennepin County coroner, held the first public auction at the City Morgue in Minneapolis. The crowd of over 100 crammed into the tight lobby of the City Morgue, attracted by terrible sadness and the allure of a weird freak show. The media later published the headline, "Gaiety at the Morgue." Dr. Seashore and his deputy coroner We're not examining dead bodies to provide answers to grieving families. Instead, they wielded gavels from an elevated position and ran up the bids with tales of more morbid and melodramatic than the one before, while holding watches, rings, knives, revolvers used in suicides, clothes, and other trinkets recovered from the pockets of unclaimed dead. The most peculiar item sold at auction was a glass eye belonging to a quote-unquote Oriental in 1930. This macabre spectacle continued for 5 decades, passed down from coroner to coroner. The county brought in $213 in 1941, the equivalent of $4,700 today. By 1955, the auctions had faded into the history books. Sensibilities had sharpened, social norms had shifted, but the law remained unchanged. Fast forward another 70 years, the scenarios have not changed. The people continue to die with full pockets, some of which goes unclaimed. The county provides for a dignified burial, offsetting expenses with any cash on hand. Soiled clothing deemed biohazardous is disposed of, but some property remains, most of which has only sentimental value. Occasionally, there is precious metal or a gemstone. When no family comes forward to make a claim and the remains are long since buried, the medical examiner is left with only one option, the public auction. The reality is that we catalog these items, place them into a forgotten corner of the office for indefinite storage. But for who? Through House File 4242, we are asking you to give the medical examiner and coroners the authority to decide what should happen to those items based on individual circumstance. Should they remain with the decedent in burial, be released to a distant blood relative not previously permitted by law to obtain them, and when necessary, allow a medical examiner or coroner to respectfully recover reasonable expenses while maintaining transparency against future claims. I'm asking you to help me bring dignity back to our unclaimed and unidentified dead. Thank you.
Okay. Are there members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay. Well, seeing none, we can move to member discussion. Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Question for you just out of curiosity with your story, very fascinating. Anything out of the ordinary recovered that you could put up for auction?
No, we don't actually auction any items now.
But
Chair McDonald.
Just, Madam Chair, thank you. Any items that would fascinate the committee here?
Director Wilson, you don't have to answer that question if you don't want to, but I mean...
I'm happy to answer the question.
Okay, yeah, sure. Director Wilson.
No, as I mentioned in my testimony, most of what is retained is of sentimental value. There is no significant value peculiarity to it. If you can imagine what you have on your person today is the type of property that we are cataloging.
Chair McDonald. Okay. Is there further discussion on the bill? All right, Chair Freiberg, closing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for your consideration of this bill. I think it makes sense to modernize these statutes and appreciate the consideration of the bill. And with that, renew my motion that it be laid over.
All right, Chair Freiberg renews his motion to lay over House File 4242, and the bill is laid over. Thank you. So the final bill on our agenda today is House File 4240, another Freiberg bill. Chair Freiberg, yeah, to your bill.
Yes, so House File, I move House File 4240. I think we discussed sending this to Ways and Means. Is that? Maybe I'll start there and then we can see how the discussion goes.
Yeah. Chair Quam, do you have comments on sending this to Ways and Means? Okay, so Chair Freiberg moves to re-refer House File 4240 to Ways and Means Committee. To your bill.
Thank you. So this proposal includes a series of election administration updates designed to improve efficiency, clarify procedures, and reduce unnecessary costs. The bill provides greater flexibility for cities administering absentee voting, standardizes the use of statewide voter registration system across elections, and clarifies early voting procedures and record-keeping requirements. The proposal also removes outdated statutory language, including references to color ballots and a duplicative list related to agent delivery eligibility. As we saw last year, the number of special legislative elections is unpredictable. This can create budgeting hardships for counties and cities who haven't planned on having 2, 4, or 6 additional elections, counting special primary and general elections. The bill establishes a reimbursement process for counties and municipalities that incur costs administering state or federal special elections not currently held in conjunction with another state election. Finally, it updates pre- and post-election timing statutes and removes the Secretary's authority related to licensing the statewide voter registration system's source code. Overall, these changes modernize election statutes, streamline administration, and provide clearer guidance for election officials while maintaining election security. And with me is Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office, and I know there is, I do have an author's amendment as well, whenever we want
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, let's just do the amendment first before we move to testimony. So, Chair Freiberg, do you want to move the A1?
Yep, I will move the A1 amendments. So this language was included in the OSS administrative bill last year, along with a similar change to hospital districts, and it would put the bill in the shape I'd like. So appreciate members' consideration.
Okay. So all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Say nay. All right. The A1 is adopted. Well, I guess, do you want to talk more about it, or should we just move to testimony? Okay. All right. Ms. Freeman.
Thank you so much, members. My name is Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. Thank you to Chair Freiberg and the committee for hearing the office's administration bill today. I will be brief because the chair spoke and covered a number of the sections. Section 1 was already covered at a high level. It allows cities that are designated as absentee voting to conduct absentee voting to do so just for 18 days instead of the full 46 if they would like. Section 2 is a technical change, and as Chair Freiberg already mentioned, it removes an out-of-date and incomplete list, and instead just cuts things off at the statutory reference back to where that full list is maintained and updated there. Section 3 standardizes the use of SVRS across all elections except for March Township elections. Sections 4 and 5 are related to early voting. Section 4 clarifies that a voter certificate needs to be printed and also needs to be retained. Section 5 just clarifies procedures that should be followed after early voting concludes. Section 6 is a provision that would allow the office to, instead of print and mail annotated, updated election laws to municipal clerks and county auditors, would instead allow us to provide them electronically. We're finding that what we've heard from clerks and county auditors repeatedly is, thanks so much for sending this to me. I'm going to put it on the shelf next to my currently saran-wrapped version from 2 years ago. And so in an effort to save in 2024, we spent $57,000 printing and mailing those. So we'd like to switch to an electronic delivery method instead. Sections 7 and 8 are cleanup language around color ballots, which haven't existed in several decades. Section 9, as the chair mentioned, creates a reimbursement structure, and I think this year our hope is just to start that conversation, understanding there may or may not be funds for this, but both state special elections as well as federal special elections, they're special, right? They happen on an unscheduled basis, and are just looking to start that conversation in order to support our local governments who have to administer those on very short notice. Section 10 is, again, a super administrative update. We have been working to standardize the timing of when notification of elections have to happen, 84 days. There was this one section in Chapter 375 that we missed, so we're putting that there. The chair spoke about the repealer, so I won't mention that, but I'm happy to take questions and discuss the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Are there members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? All right, well, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Okay, well, Chair Freiberg, do you want to close?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Co-Chair Quam. You know, I think these are a lot of common sense changes, and I appreciate the committee's consideration.
Okay, and so Chair Freiberg renews his motion to refer House File 4240 as amended to the House Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. All right, the ayes have it. The motion prevails. House File 4240 as amended is on its way to Ways and Means. And then with that, there are no more bills on our agenda. Chair Quam, I don't know if you want to give a preview for later tonight.
Basically, we're doing what we would have done if a couple of feet of snow hadn't fallen upon a large part of the state. So I anticipate some vigorous debate and moving forward with our business. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So be back here at 5 for a riveting conversation. We are adjourned.